You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Paul Manafort, former presidential campaign director for Donald Trump and now guest of the FBI, might be rethinking his earlier line on links to Russia.
That's what he said. That's obviously what our position is.
My guests Samira Shackle and Jonathan Fenby will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including what appears to be the imminent deluging of British politics by the ripples from the Harvey Weinstein scandal, and is this a strange time for the deposed government of Catalonia to undertake a works outing to Belgium? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, freelance journalist, contributor to New Statesman, Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, Monocle, and others, and Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post, now chairman of China Research and director of European Political Research at T.S. Lombard. Welcome both. We will start tonight with an extended look at Washington, where Agent Trump may already have yelled into one of the Oval Office lamps to tell Moscow's center that his cover has been blown and asking for a helicopter to collect him from the White House roof. The first indictments into Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into President Donald Trump's ties with Russia have been issued, and they do not look like the kind of thing which will be dissipated with an incantation of fake news. Paul Manafort, chairman of Trump's presidential campaign, and Rick Gates, an associate of Manafort's, are charged with various malfeasances, including money laundering and conspiracy against the United States. Possibly more damningly, former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos has pleaded guilty to making false statements to the Fed and appears to be cooperating with the investigation. Now, breaking news in the last few minutes is that Manafort and Gates have pleaded not guilty in court, and they are, of course, innocent men until proved otherwise beyond reasonable doubt and so forth. But nonetheless, Jonathan, I'll ask you first. Is it fair to say that politicians in more or less Trump's position have resigned over less than this?
They've probably, yes, I mean, some have indeed, but they weren't Trump, you can say. You know, there is a difference here. Myself, I think we're probably still at a relatively early stage of what may be a very long process. Of course, the White House is saying Papadopoulos really had nothing to do with them or the campaign and so on and so on. My mind, of course, goes back to the Watergate saga, which I'm old enough to have followed at the time. And it can sometimes take a very long time to build things up. And somebody like Trump is not going to, I think, unless he suddenly breaks and so on. Otherwise, he'll just deny it again and again. And, of course, the law can be a very slow process.
Samira, Papadopoulos especially struck me as the more significant, perhaps. I think the indictments of Manafort and Gates were possibly not that much of a surprise. I think once it became known over the weekend that somebody was getting lifted on Monday morning, odds on Manafort were pretty short. But is the fact that Papadopoulos has already pleaded guilty to making false statements to the feds about they relate to Russia's interference and appears to be cooperating, is that more significant?
I think so, yeah. When the Manafort and Gates indictment came out, there was some suggestion that perhaps the biggest indication, because of course the charges don't actually relate to Manafort's time as campaign manager for Trump, some suggestion that perhaps it would be the bigger worry for Trump would be that Manafort might then be compelled to cooperate with the investigation more and sort of give over more information. I think the sort of now new sort of surprise announcement about Papadopoulos certainly has the same concerns, and it has the extra sort of added significance of the fact that this very directly relates to the campaign itself, to the election campaign itself. And there was a kind of irony in the timing that you have Trump tweeting in his typical all capital letters, "There was no collusion!" ! Within literally minutes, if not seconds, of then his former foreign affairs advisor in fact admitting to collusion, which when you read the sort of the statement sheet that's been released about Papadopoulos, that's effectively what it amounts to.
You do wonder there if that is Robert Mueller displaying some evidence of a sense of humour in the waiting for Trump to sound off that there was no collusion and then dumping evidence to the contrary. Trump, as we speak, has been noticeably quiet since the Papadopoulos story broke.
Yes, I mean, what you get, this is a pattern that we saw. We saw it with the Italians going after the mafia. Then we saw it in Brazil with the anti-corruption drive there, where you basically have a dragnet and bring in a lot of people and bet, you being the prosecutor, that one or two of them will either break or will say, hey, it's in my interest to collaborate with the authorities. And of course, that's been used against the mafia a lot in the States too, and I'm sure it's been used elsewhere. And one of the things with that is that you never know, as you were indicating, Andrew, when that process finishes and when somebody else who's been got first time round implicated then thinks, hey, I better jump ship too, and you gradually have this building up. And this is, for instance, what's happened in Brazil with this huge scandal that's in the same way built up from fairly low levels. And we will, as I say, I think this is going to take a little bit of time.
Samira, looked at from Trump's point of view, is this the kind of thing that, you know, is going to be dealt with satisfactorily from his point of view by shouting fake news or saying, what about Hillary Clinton?
Well, it's hard to see how effective that can be. I mean, I don't doubt that he'll try to continue that strategy. I think the White House have already been distancing themselves from Papadopoulos, saying, oh, he wasn't really a proper advisor and he wasn't really very significant, he was marginal. But, you know, the fact is that was his role. There's evidence, I believe, also of him talking to his supervisor, who's not actually named in the statement, but there's some sort of indication of who his campaign supervisor was. He wasn't just sort of going off his own steam and doing this without letting anyone know. So people were aware. And while I'm sure they'll make the defence that he was relatively junior, I don't know how far that will hold. And I don't know how much they can claim that it's fake.
Because there are there not, Jonathan, in the indictment, an awful lot of blanks waiting to be filled in. Yeah, people referred to by their roles. And social media guessing game is well underway already, which it would obviously be impertinent for us to join in on. But it does seem fairly clear that these will not be the last indictments Mueller is going to hand down.
This is, as you say, there are a lot of names to be filled in. There are also, this is coming from all kinds of angles at the moment. I mean, there's been a kind of pause, but now, you know, to use a cliche, if the dam starts bursting, it's going to come from all kinds of directions. I mean, the Russian lawyer who the New York Times had a story about a couple of days ago, bringing what seemed like evidence said to be against Clinton from a Russian official source, etc., etc. And there are lots of people who've bobbed up at one point or another over the last 6 months who will be there again. And of course, the irony of this is that this is just before Donald Trump sets out on a great world statesman tour to Asia.
You think that trip's still going to happen?
Well, that's the question, you see. Does it happen? And secondly, what do we get? Do we get Trump in Beijing dealing with Xi Jinping, who's just come out of this big Communist Party Congress, very much strong, and perhaps, you know, as The Economist had it on its cover the other week, the most powerful leader in the world.
You think President Xi would rather speak to somebody important?
Well, I'm going to say that. And Trump all the time has his ear back on Washington. I mean, I remember when I was in Hong Kong, Bill Clinton came through, who'd been on a long trip to China. And we had dinner, he had a small dinner in Hong Kong, and that's the kind of thing you get when you edit the paper there. And he seemed very strained. I was very let down, because I thought it would be John Travolta from, you know, Primary Colors bounding into the room. But no, he was very quiet and so on and so on and so on. And afterwards, one of his aides said, it's the first time he's been able to talk about the Lewinsky affair with Washington, because he'd been in China and been afraid that he would have been bugged, presumably. So, you know, I just say, similarly, if Trump is dealing with this while dealing with Xi Jinping, it's really going to be a three-ring circus.
Samira, there have been a lot of concerns raised over the last few months, and especially over the last 24 hours, that Donald Trump might, much as he dismissed James Comey, attempt to sack Robert Mueller. But has Mueller, in releasing these indictments, now made himself effectively unsackable?
I would have thought so, because it's sort of the symbolism of that would be so shocking, and it'd be hard to imagine a president withstanding that. Although Trump's kind of defied expectations thus far already, as you said earlier. And I think he's probably personally quite unconcerned about whether something looks bad or not, but you'd expect that the people around him at the very least would restrict him from doing that, because it would be a very, very sort of clear on paper and documented documents that are out in the public domain.
Absolutely. And yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things one always talks about this, if you're talking about impeachment and so on, it's the Republican control of Congress. But if he got rid of Mueller, I think you would then find a lot of Republicans who would find it very difficult not to vote against him.
Well, I mean, I'll just follow that up, Jonathan, because I mean, I have sat here and said out loud at least 3 million times over the last 2 years that surely this is the point at which you know, congressional Republicans, decent conservatives, basically everybody not related to him, just finally admits this is a circus and I want no further part of it. Does this possibly get us closer to that point? Because the thing that's always baffled me about this is that all politicians, as you would know, have a keen concern for their place in posterity and how they will be regarded, you know, in history. And who would want their reputation wedded to this?
I agree completely. That's the reasonable point of view. But I don't think we're dealing with a reasonable situation here. That's the thing. And you've got this added complication now in the Republican Party with the divisions, you know, the extent of the divisions within the Republicans, Mr. Flake and I have to keep not calling him Fake, and Corker and so on, you know, great pair.
Corker,
who are, you know, who you would not normally describe as being reasonable Republicans, but who've now are cast in that guise, and these people really out on the kind of Bannon people who are out there on the range.
The thing I wonder, Samira, and this is just a theory I have absolutely no ability whatsoever to back up, so apologies
for... The best kind.
Exactly. So apologies for dumping it on you. Is it possible that Donald Trump himself has genuinely never had any idea that any of this is going on? That he is just so completely tuned into cable news and his Twitter feed that he really wasn't really paying any attention to what was going on in his name in the campaign. I realise I'm making a case here for arguing for Donald Trump as kind of a downy, unworldly innocent, but nonetheless, is it possible?
It is possible. I mean, he doesn't come across as the sharpest tool in the box, does he? And it also doesn't seem that he's not particularly concerned with staying across briefs, to say the least, you know, sort of... making sure that he's informed of all aspects of the campaign and so on. It seems like he's interested in stuff as and when it comes up. And I also think, actually, what's quite frightening is it's entirely possible that not only Trump, but at least some of the people around him maybe didn't even think about the kind of constitutional implications of this. They, from everything that's come out so far, sort of various email leaks and today's indictments and so on, it does seem that there was a real attitude that was... people sort of heard, oh, great, you've got emails about Clinton that's going to be dirt on the campaign. Fantastic, let's go for it, without really thinking about the implications of that, which I think isn't really a defence. It's actually quite frightening, the kind of level of ignorance about what the rules and laws are and protocols.
And it's the short-termism.
Exactly.
I mean, which you see the whole time in this administration and so on. And exactly as you say, you know, hey, you've got some dirt on Hillary, let's use that. Let's not ask where it comes from, whether it's true or not, which wouldn't matter very much, you know, in a campaign and so on and so on. And then you don't even take the trouble to clean up behind you and to make sure the doors are closed behind you. So, you know, you're leaving a long... paper, dirty paper trail.
I mean, with those emails, it just struck me as just the lack of common sense. If you're working on any political campaign and you get an email like that, you just call the police and not reply to it.
Yeah, well, this is amateur night at the end of the pier. You know, again and again, we're getting this in all kinds of areas. I mean, you know, I was talking about China a moment ago. Trump is going to China in 10 days' time. He has no China policy. He hasn't appointed anyone to deal with the most important foreign power he deals with. He thinks, well, assumes he thinks he can go there and just suddenly, you know, do a deal with Xi Jinping.
Samira, doubtless there will be more indictments handed down in coming weeks and months, and I don't want to get into the the entertaining though it is game of, you know, fantasy indictment bingo, but how much luck do you think Donald Trump is going to have, what with one thing and another, willing to find people who are willing to risk decades in a federal penitentiary in order to protect him?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? I guess people would perhaps be more inclined to be protecting themselves, you would expect. And I think that actually some of this, at least, the kind of short-termism and lack of concern we were talking about. I'm sure at least some of it's down to the fact that there probably is a dearth of people who are kind of canny and experienced political operators who want to work with and around Trump. You see that sort of certain key White House positions are still not filled. Yeah. While people maybe aren't putting their heads above the parapet, it's not like everyone's, you know, sort of huge swarms of people clamouring with loads and loads of political experience and credibility clamouring to work for him.
Because you can't. Because, I mean, if you, you know, if you went in, if you or I, Andrew, we went into the White House and said, OK, Mr. President, we're going to set up a defence for you and you could find something, which more or less stood up, at least on Fox News, let's say, and so on and so on. Within an hour, you would probably be destroyed by a tweet from Trump or by a change in position. You wouldn't know. I mean, that's why I don't think he can build the kind of minimal team which is needed to run the United States and run the administration, simply because who's going to put their head above the parapet?
Well, we will have much more on this on tonight's Monocle Daily at 2200. For now, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Samira Shackle and Jonathan Fenby. Coming up next, corruption in a different capital of a different sort.
For November, Monocle heads into the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, boldly going beyond the chocolate box with a big old trip to Switzerland. Uphill and down valley, our team trekked and tobogganed to bring you the extra thick cream of the crop. The cities and villages, designers, chefs, businesses and opportunities that set these fair cantons apart. Elsewhere in the pages, it's business as usual, which means highly unusual. Where else are you going to get a report from Iceland's strategic airbase? A tourbus diary from the Coptic Pope as he plays to packed crowds of believers in Melbourne? A report from the growing independence movement in the Faroe Islands? Or a trip to meet the artists ensuring Jeddah stays Saudi Arabia's most liberal city? Some extra cherries on the cake come in the form of the tour of two halves of the Yves Saint Laurent museums in Paris and Marrakesh, an absolutely gorgeous house in Tasmania that we're all fighting over to stay at, and a whistle-stop tour of the International Baking Renaissance. Now there's a sentence that makes the cake to put the cherry on in the first place. Full circle. Switzerland's wonders never cease. Monocle's November issue is out now.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Jonathan Fenby. Now, among those grateful for today's developments in Washington, D.C. are the 36 MPs from Britain's more or less governing Conservative Party, whose names have been redacted from a leaked spreadsheet apparently compiled by Tory aides to keep track of potentially scandalous sexual behaviour. The names will not stay secret long amid a global eruption of long-suppressed anger about sexual harassment and worse that has been occasioned by the Harvey Weinstein revelations. It would pose a grim dilemma even for a prime minister who wasn't clinging desperately to power. Samira, let's assume that these stories are true, or at least a reasonable fraction of them are true, which seems pretty likely. What should Theresa May do?
It's quite difficult to say really what she should do. I mean, she's announced these measures. Some of the harassment that's been alleged about MPs in Westminster, some of it comes down to the sort of poor practices to deal with it and poor practices through which to make complaints because of the way that the House of Commons is sort of managed on a procedural level. The fact that within an MP's office, you're basically hired by the MP, and so any complaints are handled internally, which if you're alleging harassment by that MP is obviously has some inbuilt flaws. So I think what she's announced about setting up a process by which people can report this stuff to a kind of central body who will investigate it, I think that's really good. But you know, it's kind of less almost about what any individual prime minister can do, I think, or any individual boss, and more about much wider cultures. And there's the fact that Westminster remains quite kind of male-dominated, masculine environment, despite improvements in female representation. There's the fact that lots of people really, really want to work there. And so in the same way that with the film industry, that makes kind of young people vulnerable to exploitation, I think, or different forms, that's also true probably in the world of politics. And I think also just, yeah, as I said before, the kind of poor procedures across the board. This is an antiquated institution that doesn't necessarily have very clear kind of frameworks and bodies to report things. And that kind of masculine culture, I think, probably makes it quite hard for a young woman who's very keen to be taken seriously and prove themselves in the kind of serious world of politics, which is a bit of an uphill struggle as a young woman anyway, maybe doesn't want to report things. So it's just putting in place measures that enable those complaints to come through and changing the culture so there's no need for the complaints in the first place.
I mean, Jonathan, is there potentially a political advantage to Theresa May in being seen to clean house on this subject? Quite apart from it being obviously the right thing to do, long overdue, and so forth. What we have learned, I don't know if learned is the right word, or something that certainly should have been more widely understood before the last few weeks, was that this is far from unique to Hollywood. It's very, very common in politics for all the reasons that Samira just outlined.
And not just at Westminster.
But the other thing that we have learned, rather depressingly, in the last few weeks, that there's no shortage of people willing to make excuses for it or blame the victims for it.
Well, I think the culture at Westminster, I mean, it is pretty antiquated, Westminster. Yeah, male-dominated, certainly. But also beyond that, it's the whole clubby atmosphere of Westminster, which has always been there. And, I mean, to answer your question, yes. I mean, if May can be seen to do something to bring in accountability to her own clan group, the Conservative Party in the House of Commons, that maybe one of the kind of, you know, firm decisions or firm things that she needs and will want to do. But, I mean, reading about this, you know, I'm going to go back down memory lane. God, I seem to be the old man here always talking about this. You know, I'm reminded fatally of the early 1990s when I was here editing the Observer newspaper, and it was a weak Conservative Prime Minister.
This was John
Major at that time. And every Saturday we would go into the Observer and we'd sit there, and of course we, being a, you know, a respectable broadsheet newspaper, didn't deal with sleaze and such and such and so on. But we'd almost have this joke at the news conference: is it worth doing a front page in advance, because one of the tabloids is going to break an MP sex scandal tonight and we will remake the paper. It was almost every week there was a series, and this did weaken Major's government quite considerably.
These were different sort of sex scandals, though, of that time. Involved consenting adults. They may have been undignified, scandalous, and so on and so forth. But Samira, what we've been talking about in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal is something else entirely. What was it, do you think, about Weinstein in particular that has rippled so far beyond that? Is it just that it happened in a social media age? Because clearly what we have learned is that, as we were saying, it was far from unique to Hollywood. Harvey Weinstein, though he may have been an especially prolific offender in this regard, was not unusual in behaving with that sense of entitlement either. But why him and why now?
It's interesting. I think there's multiple reasons. I'm sure social media is part of it, but I do think that I've actually heard almost frustration amongst some friends and so on who've been involved with feminist causes for a long time, because actually women have been speaking about this stuff for a long time, but it's not really a kind of a revelation to lots of people, I think. But probably in answer to your question, a big part of it is the fact that the women who are speaking out about Harvey Weinstein are, first of all, white women, second of all, a very glamorous, respectable industry that lots of people want to be in, or that lots of people look up to or glamorize. And so they're kind of aspirational figures who are less easy to dismiss. And they're also quite culturally prominent figures. So we're not talking about women who can be written off or dismissed out of hand. These are women who are really, really well known, and not just known to people who are interested in politics or whatever. I mean, it's quite hard to avoid people with the prominence of Gwyneth Paltrow or Angelina Jolie or whatever. So I think that's probably a really big part of it. That kind of removes some of the shame of talking about it, that you have this raft of incredibly famous women coming in and speaking out about this. I think that's probably a big part of it.
And I think also, I mean, to turn the thing on its head, and at the risk of getting into deep waters, this story, the Weinstein story, in itself sells newspapers.
Yeah.
It sells media. It's a great story in those terms. So it's going to get a lot of pickup across a lot of the press, which might not necessarily, ipso facto, feel one with those who are bringing this to light and so on. So there's a kind of double turn here.
Well, let's look finally at Catalonia, where over the weekend we heard from the large numbers of people who don't wish to pursue independence from Spain. A crowd several hundred thousand strong demonstrated in Barcelona in favour of national unity. In more recent developments, Spain's chief prosecutor has called for charges against Catalan leaders, including rebellion, which carries a potential 30-year jail sentence. And the deposed Catalan president Carles Puigdemont, along with some of his ministers, has turned up in Brussels for some reason. Samira, first of all, the demonstrations at the weekend, did they change the argument? Did they shift things?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the argument was already there that there were at the very least question marks over the referendum. I think although it was a 90% or something vote in favour of independence, it was on a 43% turnout.
Illegal referendum as well.
Exactly. But I think even if you take the illegality out of the question, the fact that you're talking less than half of the electorate is turning out, then I think you have to ask questions about its validity. And I think the numbers of people turning out on the streets add sort of weight to those questions.
Do you get the sense, Jonathan, that Mr. Puigdemont may rather have overplayed his hand?
Yes. Yeah, I think the Catalans have bitten off more than they can chew, if we can say that. And they're finding themselves, I mean, okay, Rajoy has taken too hard a line, in a sense, and this has exacerbated things, but of course he's playing to an electorate in the rest of Spain. But I think the Catalans are finding that they have gone rather too far, and that there is actually not really much of a fallback position for them. There are going to be elections now in December. The latest polls show the Unity Party just ahead, but it's pretty narrow, and who knows how that will turn out. But I think, you know, if he's in Brussels seeking aid and comfort, he's not going to find very much.
Well, yeah, on the subject of Brussels, Samira, there are various lurid rumours suggesting that he's planning to seek asylum in Belgium. These are unconfirmed, I hasten to stress, but does it strike you as an odd thing to do at a moment like this, to skip out of the country?
Yeah, although they are talking about potentially jailing him within the next 2 months, I think so. It's maybe not entirely surprising.
Well, I mean, from the point of view of one's own self-preservation, I mean, if Spain was was offering to put me in prison for 30 years, I probably wouldn't go there myself. But, but having just sort of attempted to lead his people to freedom, this seems a bit weak, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
it is a bit
having declared independence, would you then take the plane and go into exile and set up your independent government in exile?
Well, maybe that's what he's doing.
It may be the best thing he can hope for, you know, if you're really pushing it to the extreme.
I mean, is there a plausible resolution to this, Jonathan? I mean,
there are
elections on December 21st, and obviously Spain's government will hope that they get a pluralistic turnout, and that will hopefully provide a result which, from Madrid's point of view, will put this to bed again. But
yes, you could see more autonomy granted to Catalonia, more financial, less. Catalonia paying less into the central budget and so on and so on. You can do all kinds of measures like that. But then the question is, that since Rajoy has raised the temperature considerably with his very hardline approach, whether the rest of Spain would go along with that, or whether they will start to say, these Catalans don't give them anything. This could be rooted for a long time to come. It's going to be rooted for a long time to come, and it may be increasingly difficult to find papering over compromises.
Just to return finally, Samira, to the demonstrations at the weekend, did you get the sense, and this is me projecting my own prejudices, for which apologies, that they rather caught out a lot of the international media coverage, which bought massively in, I think, to the kind of hip, cool, groovy, freedom-seeking Catalans, and I think were quite surprised to discover that a lot of them thought otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, you did see in defence of the coverage, there was sort of sentences here and there about the fact that it was only a 43% turnout. But yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a kind of tendency to fall on familiar narratives, and the narrative of the kind of underdogs striving for independence is an appealing one.
Well, I think you're quite right. The hip Catalans That's the people in Barcelona along the coast. A lot of the real independent, hardline independents are back in the farms where the tourists don't go.
That does bring us to the end of today's show. Jonathan Fenby and Samira Shackle, thanks for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Tasha Kleeman and Chloe Carnesis. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. Music next at 1900. It's Culture with Robert Bound. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.